outside the box of religious obligation lies a road less travelled, into the heart of the Father's affection. Slinging freedom all over the place, this is the God Gen.
Well, a couple of weeks ago, Kyle, I went to one of those Sunday morning things.
You went to a Sunday morning thing?
I did.
What inspired you slash captured you, kidnapped you into going to a Sunday morning thing?
It was almost that. I've got a friend who knows somebody down here who's planting a congregation in the area, has been for the last 3 years or so. He said the pastor's read So Don't Want Church Anymore, really loves that book, thinks like that, thinks like you, wants to get together. So we met for lunch one day, and yeah, it was an interesting lunch. I think I appreciate some of the hungers of his heart, but I don't think he completely knows the direction he's going in. So I woke up on Sunday morning. I thought, you know what? I'm just going to go over there. We didn't have much going on. So I thought, I'm going to go over there and just see, because he wanted me maybe to do some things with the group. And I'm like, I don't really know. Let me go over and just check it out. And What was interesting, though, is I get there, and over the wall, because it's an outdoor service, and because of COVID, and they're celebrating their third anniversary day. I didn't realize that. But I get there, and I hear this beautiful music coming over the wall. I mean, just ripping your heart good stuff. And I'm like, oh, crud, I don't want this to be good. I mean, at least the music part of it, because I know that's the bait in the trap. And
you know, that's the hook.
That is the hook. But it was awesome. And so I get through about 15 greeters who are trying to get you sign up for things and give you stuff and just do all that. Finally got in there, and the whoever had been singing had stopped singing. And so I was just talking to a few people, meeting some people as I was getting settled. And lady comes up and gives him, Wayne Jacobson, what are you doing here? And gives me this big hug. And it's my neighbor from two houses up the street. And
oh my gosh.
I go, what are you doing here? She goes, is this where you go? And I said, no, not exactly. This is my first time here. She goes, this is my first time too. I said, well, what are you doing here? She said, we're actually doing the music today. They've invited us, me and my daughter, to come in and do the music. And I knew she sings. She's been on AGT. She's been on Dancing with the Stars. She's a very gifted singer. I knew that.
Okay.
Never heard her sing live. Seen her doing on TV. And so I didn't know her daughter sang at all. So I'm going, well, this will be fun, this part of it. So sure enough, they did about 12 minutes of quote-unquote worship, what that group calls worship. 12 minutes. I could have gone with 40 minutes of that and like 12 minutes of the sermon. The pastor wasn't there, so I didn't get help reading on that. He was homesick with COVID, which is interesting. We talked a few weeks before about vaccine, and he says, vaccines are splitting my whole church, man. You can't talk about vaccines. You can't talk about masks. I mean, everybody's all over the place and strong motions on both sides of it. And I said, yeah, but you probably ought to get it. You're with a lot of people. And then 2 weeks later, he's got the COVID. He's home with his family. They've all got it. And so his brother-in-law came up and did some speaking. And I'm telling you, that was 40 minutes. It was kind of tough to sit through. It was the normal religious way of thinking through. It was called the Rules of Wisdom, which was kind of, just the start of it. I went, oh boy, it's going to be tough. But then after that, they asked the team to come back, music team. And so my neighbor and her daughter get up front and sing, and they sang a Southern gospelized version of His Eye Is on the Sparrow. And I tell you, I could have walked into glory right there, that close to it. It was just magnificent. And made me think, though, you know, we had got a pretty good sized patio out here back. And a few years ago, we had a friend who was a Broadway actor who won Tony Awards and stuff for being in musicals. And he was prepping up a concertish kind of thing with some Irish ballads, acoustic guitar. And I go, man, why don't you come do it on my back patio? We'll invite people. And we had 80 people sitting on my back patio. And he did this concert, sharing stories. And I'm going, I told Sarah when I got back, we have to do that with our neighbors. We have to talk to them. Hey, would you guys do a concert on our back patio? You invite people, we'll invite people. And so, man, that was fun.
Have you talked to anybody yet? Have you talked to them? Are they interested in doing this with you?
I suspect they will be, but I don't know yet because we've been out of town. And so I haven't had a chance to get up there and see what we're going to do. We'll probably get together this weekend. We've been talking about it. So hopefully we will. And we'll talk about doing it. So right now we're coming into the cold months. We did it on the cold months. We had to get some heaters and try and keep people warm. And so maybe something we do in the spring. But
so remind me again, it's been 6 years since I've lived in Southern California. What do the cold months mean to you?
Oh, yeah. It gets way down in the upper 50s. Just brutal.
I remember suffering in the winters in Southern California. I just couldn't remember how cold it got there.
It is. You have to wear sleeves and stuff. Like, who wears sleeves? at least long sleeves. But I do wear the short sleeves, man, because I'm not into the tank top look. Yeah, I just am wearing long sleeves today because it's not even getting to 70 today. It's pretty chilly out here. It's fall in California.
Are your palm trees turning colors?
I don't have a palm tree on my property. Sarah and I hate them, so they do not exist here. But around the area, they're just as green as they always. They always are turning brown on the bottom and green on top. And it depends on how much people keep them trimmed. Yeah, no, I've got nothing turning out here.
None of Sarah's trees will flower at all or change color?
Not yet, man. It's been the 80s, you know.
Okay. That makes sense.
I'm going to be in Virginia next week, man. And I look at the color line. The color line, I'm going to be there till Halloween. So I'm going to get some good color, I think, in Virginia.
Oh, yeah.
That'll be
You're going to get some gorgeous color there.
It'd be great. I've missed it the other places I've been. So what's the best thing you heard this week, Kyle?
The best thing I heard this week was actually having a conversation with a parent. And in the midst of that conversation, the statement came up, no bad choice is beyond the reach of love. We were talking about parenting teenagers. And that was this parent's comment, was that no bad choice that their student could make was beyond the reach of love.
Except the choice not to be loved.
True.
I mean, I like what you're saying. There is no choice that love can't reach to. Get it. But there are choices people make that put them outside the scope of love.
Yes, there are. Sometimes people do make those choices to distance themselves from love or to not receive that love. We talked a couple of weeks ago about the prodigal son and about what you've been learning with the father and the father actually allowing his son to leave, to actually go away and to make those choices where he was beyond the reach of his father's love.
Yeah, because the other thing about love is it doesn't force itself on someone. So you can absolutely love and reach into someone's bad choices, and hopefully they're willing to turn and embrace that love. But I've got some people in my life who've making some bad choices and still are. And love for them means you'll just pretend they're not doing what they're doing. And I have a hard time going there. I always do. I have a hard time knowing how to love somebody who is actively working to destroy the relationship or your relationship with other people. How do you love in that environment except to let them go until they're ready to turn around and be loved, I guess?
Again, that's an expression of love when you're not willing to succumb to either abuse or lies or gaslighting when that's being pressed on you and saying, well, this is the box that you have to fit in order for us to be able to experience love. It's like that isn't very loving either.
Yeah, but the Christian thing to do in most of our culture is you just make nice even to people who are acting in evil ways.
That's very true.
And it's one thing to love. You can love people who are acting in evil ways. But you don't love them by necessarily going along with it. And if not going along with it puts you outside their reach, then you're outside their reach for a while, sadly.
So what about you?
Yeah, my best thing of the month kind of goes along with that in a little different way. It's Thomas Hobbes, a 17th century philosopher, in his book Leviathan, which Leviathan is the power of the massive state that's out to destroy people. He said this, very brief, hell is truth seen too late.
Oh, okay.
And I know there's lots of controversy about hell today. Hell is truth seen too late. And you don't have to take that to, you know, the afterlife and hell and all that. You can take that just to life in this age. When you are living a lie, living by a lie, what we were just talking about, then you come to realize, oh my gosh, I've been in this lie and that's been hurtful to you. But I know people who've done that with me who've wasted 15, 16, 17 years of relationship before they turn around and go, could we talk? I'm going, yeah, we can always talk. Yeah. But you've wasted 16 years of a friendship we could have had because you wanted to what? And I know it's a lot giving into flesh and weakness and brokenness, but a lot of it's lies. A lot of the growth, I think, in this Christian journey is learning to separate between what's not real and what is real. And when you live by what's not real, convinced it is, then you're living hell on earth. You just, hell is truth realized too late. And None of us have a corner on that. None of, and that's the humility I think we have to live in. I don't know all truth. Yeah. I don't know what in my life right now isn't true that I'm believing. I don't know that because I wouldn't be believing it, but I'm trusting that God would reveal it as he can in his way. But to be able to know you're engaged with deceit and use it as a tactic for something, that's a different story entirely. What's the worst thing you heard this week?
I've been keeping track of just the culture and what's been going on at a local Sunday morning gathering in my area. Got a longstanding history with them. The former pastor was the pastor that is a longtime friend of Jess and I's. He married Jess and I. I've been having some conversations with some people that are in that community, and there's been some mixed questions about where the culture is going. And I was listening to the sermon for this week, and there was this really interesting situation. The pastor was talking about being on mission and not getting distracted by the things of the world. And so he was talking about this church that was planted in Georgia, and the church was going okay, but they started to get into some financial issues and weren't bringing in enough money in the Sunday morning gatherings. And so they decided to start having a chicken dinner. People start coming.
I like chicken.
Yeah, it was, I mean, good, great, deep fried Southern chicken.
Might go for that.
They start bringing that. They start doing these dinners. People start showing up. They start doing community. They start doing life with these people. Well, it keeps growing and growing and growing. And their Sunday morning gathering keeps getting less and less and less. Well, then it morphs into a restaurant. And now the restaurant is still in existence. They're still doing life with the community. But the quote-unquote Sunday morning gathering or the quote-unquote church is no longer in existence. This pastor was pointing to that experience as this is what happens when you lose sight of the vision and when you get off track and when you lose mission and, you know, when you are not following the Holy Spirit anymore and you're not doing what you're supposed to be doing, you end up with a restaurant and not the church that God sent you out to start. And I was, oof, man, my lens was like, well, I guess that's one way to look at it.
I think another way to look at it is we're going to start serving chicken on Sunday mornings and encouraging community and eating around tables is the way the gospel grows in the world.
Well, and just the fact that they couldn't recognize, or at least this in his illustration, he couldn't acknowledge that God might have been doing something different. He might have been saying, hey, the people that are coming to your quote unquote restaurant that you're doing life with, they would never step foot in your church doors. But they're willing to come and eat chicken with you and do life and have a conversation over a table with you. I couldn't believe it, though, when that was being used as an illustration of how to fail at doing church and how to lose sight of the mission.
Yeah, well, we have a mutual friend who sent us a link to a podcast this week, and I guess you were already listening to it. The podcast was called Gangster Capitalism.
I have been.
Looking into the Jerry Falwell Jr. kind of scandal with Liberty University and all that, so I thought I'm kind of interested. I'll see what this is all about. And actually, one of the episodes I listened to yesterday, I learned something that has plagued me for the last 5-6 years. And that is, how did evangelicalism become so linked to Trump in the early days? Because this always bothered me. I know Jerry Falwell Jr. was one of the first guys to kind of bring Trump into evangelicalism and kind of introduce him around to get him known. And it was at Liberty University where Trump makes a speech of, I'm going to protect you, Christians. You're never going to have to worry again because I'm going to have your back and I'm going to take care of you. I'm going to protect you from all the evils that are in the world. And I've always thought, you know, for a man who is so amoral, how could somebody like the president or Jerry Falwell Sr.'s son be the conduit into that so many others bought into? And a lot of it was a prior relationship, and then found out that there was actually a video traveling around that someone had that was compromising for Jerry Falwell Jr. And this was way before the scandal we learned about in the last year or so with the pool boy and all that, but involved in that arena. He at one point, Big Trump, before he was a candidate, had talked to Trump's lawyer / fixer, Michael Cohen, and kind of said, hey, I need help with this. I'm being sued. And they're using this video as blackmail leverage to get a better settlement and blah, blah, blah. And Michael, he doesn't say how, but he made it go away. I don't know how he made it go away. And that was 2 or 3 years before Trump decided to run for president. And then when he runs for president, Michael Cohen comes back to Jerry Falwell Jr. and says, hey, did you a favor. You don't want that coming back on you, do you? You need to endorse Trump. And according to the podcast, that this was not just an embracing of someone that was ideal, but blackmailed in some form to get involved, and he was the door. And it's always bothered me, because I think most of the people I have followed Jesus with my whole life would be more committed to something more moral and powerful than the idea that we can have Donald Trump. And I know people listening to this podcast really love Donald Trump and hate when I do this, but this is a very divisive man. If he's a bully, even people I know who like Trump will say he's a bully. Yeah, but he's our bully. And then I heard this title. This is interesting to me. There's a Dr. Kristen Cobes Demez who wrote a book called Jesus and John Wayne: How White Evangelicals Corrupted a Faith and Fractured a Nation. And I heard the title of that and then heard her talk a little bit on the podcast. I said, you know what? I'm going to invite her to this podcast. I'm going to read the book first, but I'm going to invite her. Would you like to come on this podcast with us? Because I would really love to know what she's a researcher. So I've read the first part of the book already. A lot of research in there about what happened as to why white evangelicals link so deeply to Trump and how that disfigured the faith, which I think it has. I know people disagree with me, but what Jesus gets associated with because of the white evangelical political activity of the last 5 years is a bit unnerving to me. I don't think Jesus really enjoys being disfigured by some of the things done and said in his name by some people. Anyway, that's the worst thing I heard this week, but at least it made sense as to why that happened the way it did.
There were definitely some pieces that fell together for me as well when I listened to that episode. It pegged my yuck meter really hard. After I listened to that podcast episode, I had to stop listening to it because I was like, Lord, how deep does the corruption and the grabbing for power and the manipulation go? Like, is there no bounds to this? Like, I started to get a little jaded and just my yuck meter was pegging on extreme and I had to stop listening to that podcast for a little bit.
I'm a little hooked right now because one of the things this Dr. Demez said is that protecting the brand has become the theme of these religious groups whenever there's a scandal.
Oh, absolutely.
Whenever there's a sexual assault of some kind in the church or the school. I know it's been out here. There's been universities linked to Master's College. I've had some sexual problems and sexual assaults on campus. And it's sometimes by the leadership. And then it's buried because nobody wants to have it seen. And the idea is they're protecting the brand of Christianity by joining together to hide the sin.
Yes.
Instead of letting sin be accountable and sin be, yeah, definitely forgiven and repented of, but also known so that other people aren't put at risk by these predators that use God's name to be, and I don't know if it's predators so much, it's just weak fleshy people, but some of the stories that come out of these places, and it's not just Liberty,
no.
There's a whole lot of them, and everything gets hidden and masked and put down, and there's this whole club of religious leaders who try to protect the brand. The idea of the brand is Jesus, but it really isn't. The brand is them and their reputation, and they're worried that if they were really known what was going on around here, Jesus' name would be sullied. And I think that's a reason to expose it, because when you expose stuff and say, look, Jesus has no part in this, that's really good, even for the perpetrator. That's good for the community. That's good for the world. But man, the idea that we're protecting the brand by hiding the sin is just discouraging to me. But that's the world we live in. I don't know if there's coming. We talked about it on here a while back, a day of reckoning. Are we to a time where it's so dark and people are so deluded that God's attempts to woo people back into himself just goes unheard, unacknowledged, because we're so wrapped up in our fears and anxieties and trying to get somebody to do the world the way I want the world to work for me and my group, that maybe a day of reckoning is at hand. I don't know.
Yeah, and I love the research that she's doing, and I hope that she accepts the invite to join us on the podcast. It would be a blast just to get to hear her heart and where that research has gone. And because I continued, I've actually finished. I'm current on the podcast. I didn't stop listening to it. I definitely have to admit.
Does she come back on?
No, she not yet. Anyway, so
yeah, I thought the perspective of the book would be interesting for at least those of us. I know some of us don't want to deal with this because we like our political affiliation. And if people aren't on my side, this is the thing I really hate, though. People who write me to say, oh, if you're not where we are, then you're a mainstream media, left-wing, woke, you know, whatever. And I'm not that either. I think they're just as dangerous to the world as the right wing, who's not adequately displaying the glory of Christ in the world or the priorities of Jesus in the world because they've got an agenda going on. But that's a conversation for another day, perhaps. Two emails quick. I thought this was good. This was from Kenneth on C.S. Lewis' view of spiritual warfare after our last podcast. This is from the Screwtape Letters, and this is a quote from C.S. Lewis. "There are two equal and opposite errors into which our race can fall about the devils. One is to disbelieve in their existence. The other is to believe and to feel to excessive and unhealthy interest in them. They themselves are equally pleased by both errors and hail a materialist or a magician with the same delight." I think that sums up well what we talked about, man. There is such a thing as spiritual warfare and demonic presences, and that's all true. At the same time, it's also true we become so preoccupied with them that they also win.
I love that quote. Have you read the Screwtape Letters?
Oh, yeah, often.
Oh, my gosh.
A number of times.
Man, I remember the first time I read Screwtape Letters and that quote came, and I was like, ooh, okay. And that was when I was transitioning out of some of my days with YWAM and some of that side of my journey. And it was like, okay, that is such a more healthy perspective than where I've been living in for the last little bit.
It's such an amazing book. For those of you that haven't read it, it's an older devil counseling a younger devil, at least experienced. I don't know if they're at different ages, but yeah, a more inexperienced devil about how to tempt humanity. And it's kind of interesting because you're getting advice from the dark side. Yeah. And poking fun at it, and yet so much of it just really unpacks the strategies the enemy uses. Anything to distract us from Jesus, to prey on our fears, to whatever. He does it. I also got this, too, from my friend Lewis. This was a comment on the YouTube, one of the YouTube videos. So what a fantastic story. Perhaps it is completely true, perhaps not. Either way, it ultimately leads to disappointment. If it's not true, then you are inspiring false hope that leads to disappointment. If it is true, it is an experience that so many desire but never have, which also leads to disappointment. That's an excerpt from I had a long conversation with him on the YouTube thing because I think that's the danger. It is true. I wouldn't put it out if I wasn't absolutely convinced. And I have grilled Lewis on the details of the stories he tells.
Yeah.
I'm convinced it's absolutely true. Is it horrible for those who want to have such experiences and don't have them? And that's always the danger, right? You can do that from the Bible. Yeah, I mean, a lot of people have. Jesus said, I can move mountains. So out there praying for mountains to move and mountains don't move. And so Jesus is a liar. I'm no good at this or whatever. I talk to, you know, scores of people every month that are disillusioned in faith because God's not doing what they would expect him to do.
Yeah.
Or they've sought experiences. I've only had two from the My Friend Lewis thing that have just, I would love to have an angel do this or say that. But what they don't remember is there's like 25 years or 30 years of Lewis's life where he's not making those connections. God's loving him in ways he can't see and he's not engaged with. And it's only later in life some of those threads have been pulled together. And I think that's true for all of us. I think there's lots, like the quote I used earlier, hell is truth realized too late. I mean, there's ways God's been loving every one of us, but I know people get cycled into, it's got to be a certain way, whether it's a subjective thing or a logical thing. I've got to have God, I'll know God is real. And if he cares about me, he's going to make himself known my way. When you relax and let God reveal himself to you the way he wants to, you'll be more aware of it. When you're wanting it inside a certain reality or you want someone's experience from the Bible or some testimony you heard at a retreat somewhere. Yes, Lewis's story is a fantastic story. It's unbelievably incredible. If you haven't heard My Friend Lewis yet, you might go pick it up. It's fantastic. But it ought to encourage us. And this is most of the emails I get are from people saying, you know, Lewis really helped me see in my own life where God's been revealing himself to me that I missed in my pain, that I missed in my struggle. And Lewis was telling me the other day, he said, I've looked at my whole past as just one big whole horror of pain until recently. Now I look back and yes, there was lots of pain there, but so God was there too. And now because I see how God was there, the pain I went through is now redemptive, and there's a way to share what God has done in my heart with other people, which he's doing in spades with all kinds of people. I love how that works in our hearts and lives. But I do get this, I do hear this anxiety at times of being saying, you know, if you're sharing a story that good, and I'm telling people it is an outlier story, it's the best story I've ever heard, which means there was a lot of pain in Lewis's life that he needed to be rescued from.
Yeah.
And why God took these extraordinary measures, and he doesn't do it the same way with us. But I think when we look back from eternity, God will have been with all of us in extraordinary ways, and many of us missed him because we were too busy or too demanding. It fit a certain level of expectations.
Well, I've also had conversations with people who have experienced God in the miraculous, and then they're in those seasons where he isn't showing himself that way, and they're really frustrated and discouraged because they had these powerful encounters with the heart of God, but now they're just doing life, and they feel like, well, what's wrong with me? You know, what am I not praying enough? Like, do I need to do something different? Like, what's wrong with me now? Because I had this crazy experience before, and yet he's not relating to me like that anymore. And so now what do I do? Has he abandoned me? Like, have I lost faith? Am I not praying? You know, the laundry list of things that I haven't been doing, right? That's another challenging space too.
It is, but I look at it like when God's done a certain work in my heart, made himself known a certain way, and now that's not happening in the same way. I used to get frustrated by that same thing. And now I look at it as, well, he's expanding my heart now to see him in a different way. And if we can grab onto that instead of, you know, like I said a couple of years ago, I was with the Jesus people movement. They were still born in revival and they've lived in captivity. They're still coveting an experience that was God moving in a moment and somehow I want to live there instead of, no, I want to go on with him. How is God making himself known to me today? That's the prayer of my heart every morning. How are you making yourself known today? And I don't want to necessarily go back to the same things that used to work, expecting them to work. I want to know what you're doing in my heart today that's alive and real and transformative.
So, Wayne, shifting gears a little bit, I was doing the training this last week, and I don't know if you're familiar with Clifton Strength Finders at all. Is that something you're familiar with?
I know about Strength Finders in general, but I don't know Clifton's specifically.
That's one of the things that I use in some of my life coaching work that I do with young adults and with teens. And I've been going through a deeper level of training on it so that I am better equipped to be able to help my clients. They usually start off with your top five strengths. Those are the top five themes or things that you do in your life that you don't even recognize you're doing them, but other people look at you and say, how do you do those things? Like, how do you do that so effortlessly? Or how is that a part of your life? Or that would kill me to have to do that when you see somebody else thriving in those spaces. I actually have been through this training. You go through all 34 strengths, where you fall in those, et cetera. And so I was going through my top 10 and I heard this one called the relator. And as I was reading through the description, you came to mind. And I was like, man, I've got to share this with Wayne. So it says the relator describes your attitude towards your relationships. In simple terms, the relator theme pulls you towards people you already know. You do not necessarily shy away from meeting new people. In fact, you may have other themes that cause you to enjoy the thrill of turning strangers into friends. But you do derive a great deal of pleasure and strength from being around your close friends. You are comfortable with intimacy. Once the initial connection has been made, you deliberately encourage a deepening of the relationship. You want to understand their feelings, their goals, their fears, and their dreams, and you want them to understand yours. You know that this kind of closeness implies a certain amount of risk. You might be taken advantage of, but you are willing to accept that risk. For you, a relationship has value only if it is genuine. And the only way to know that is to entrust yourself to the other person. The more you share with each other, the more you risk together. The more you risk together, the more each of you proves your caring is genuine. These are your steps towards real friendship. And you take them willingly.
You sent that to me a week ago. What in that made you think of me?
One of the biggest ones is that you know that this kind of closeness, that level of sharing, of making your life open to others, that level of vulnerability implies a certain amount of risk. You might be taken advantage of, which I have seen you be taken advantage of. I know your story, but you are willing to accept that risk. And I've seen you do that. I've seen you be deeply wounded by being available to people, by putting your heart out there, by wanting to create genuine connection with others. And seeing you been burned by it, but also seeing your life flourish in very rich relationships all over the world. And I think that's because you're willing to take that risk, that after, you know, after a few of the times that you got burned, a lot of people would have shut down. A lot of people would have withdrawn themselves from people, or been much more selective of being like, oh no, I only have a couple people in my life that I trust. I'm not creating new relationships. Or if I do, they're going to be more surface. I'm not going to let them in. But I've seen you continue to keep your heart open to people and continue to allow yourself to be vulnerable to people. So that was one of them. And then the other one, I think you do enjoy meeting new people. That, so that talk about the, in simple terms, the relator theme pulls you towards people you already know. You don't necessarily shy away from meeting new people. In fact, other themes in your life may cause you to enjoy the thrill of turning strangers into friends. I think you enjoy doing life with people and enjoy meeting new people and just doing journey with people. But one of the things that I've really seen you do intentionally is you want to understand their feelings, their goals, their fears, and their dreams. When I've seen you both in my own life and then in the lives of others, when you sit down and whether it be at a coffee shop or whether it be in a larger group or a larger context, those are some of the things that I see you live out consistently since I've known you in 2010, 2011 that we met. And so consistently I've seen those themes in the way that you relate to others. And so, yeah, as I was reading through that, I was like, man, I see Wayne live a lot of these things out in his day to day. And we had just gotten back from our Michigan trip and getting to do that together. And that was a lot of fun. I deeply enjoyed that. And yeah, it was just really intriguing. So those were some of the primary themes that stuck out to me.
Yeah. When you sent me this, man, I had a good laugh. And I just by seeing the title of it, Relator, because this is definitely a post 1994 work of God in my heart. Before that, I was very task oriented. People wouldn't say I was a relator, even though I look back at I have deep relationships back through the whole of my life, even other places I worked and other people. I've got friendships that go back 40 years, go back to college days, high school days. So, yeah. So some of that's pretty incredible. But at the time I was known for being a task guy. My high school counselor told me, you don't even like people, when she asked what I was going to try and do with my life.
Seriously?
Yeah, I scored in the bottom 2% of the nation in sociological concerns when I took an aptitude test in high school. And for me, that was somewhat rigged, right? Because they were asking questions like, would you rather go to an aviation factory and see how planes are made or go talk to somebody in a rest home? I was like, okay, I'm an aviation dude, so that's not even a close choice for me. But then it comes out that you don't like people, obviously, or you like planes more than people. And I know some of the knock on me in my pastoring days was that I was insensitive, and I think I was. I was driven by Wayne's need to be important. So I can look back and say, yeah, I've always had a heart for, I think, good friends. Even the first church I pastored, I was told I was not allowed to have friends there. I had to have friends elsewhere, but... And that was mostly in the denomination with like people you went to Bible college with, but I didn't go to that Bible college. I wasn't in that denomination. I'd go to conventions and, you know, district gatherings, and it was like family reunions. They all knew each other, but I didn't know anybody there. And when you connect with somebody like once a year, that's what you want to do. You don't want to necessarily meet new people. So Sarah and I often ended up on the fringes of that going, yeah, what are we doing here? And people would like be nice to us and talk to us, but no one like wanted a friendship with us. They had too many friendships there to explore, which... I know when people were coming to the fellowship that I pastored back in the day would say that this so close-knit here, it's hard to break into it. And sometimes it is, because everybody's got their friends. They haven't seen them all week long. They're just going to see them these 10 minutes after service or 15. So they're glomming onto their close friendships, and it's sometimes difficult for people to break into that.
Yeah.
But I know as love has won me into God's heart, I read through this going, yeah, some of this is really... different for me. It's not how I've grown up. It's not what I would say are my natural inclinations. That's why I always lead these personality things to say, you know what? Some of this stuff changes when God's love gets in your heart. Because some of the ways you act toward people and toward situations are more coping mechanisms to protect us, like you said, from hurt or whatever.
Yeah.
But I do. One of the things that really hit me out of this is I really value sincerity. A real disconnect for me is when people start lying or gossiping. I don't know how to love there. I don't. Particularly if the gossip is directed about me, particularly if I know you know you're lying, but you're still willing to lie. And someone recently looked me in the face and they asked me a question. I gave them an answer. And they said, I don't believe you. And I said, what? I said, I don't believe you. I said, well, I don't know where we go then. I would lie to you. Why? I don't know, but you just are. And it was, they didn't get the answer they wanted. That was where it was. They want me to say a certain thing because now in this group of people that I'm related to, believing this certain thing is required to participate in the relationships going forward. Mm-hmm. But that thing is a lie. So I'm not going there. And I just, you know, if that means I step away, that means I step away. Because sincerity, once you can call me a liar to my face, then where do we talk about anything?
Yeah.
I always give people the benefit of the doubt. I think you're at least trying to tell me the truth. Even if you're not being honest with yourself, you're at least telling me the best way you see it. And I'm going to give weight to your words. I'm not going to just dismiss out of hand because I don't like the answer I got. I may probe it more. Yeah, what would make you say that? I would like to hear more about why you feel that way. I mean, I would do that.
Yeah.
But sincerity to me is the soil in which relationships grow. Any pretense, and we've shared often in this how Sarah, through the first 20 years of our marriage, was so trying to be a good wife that she wasn't being genuine with herself, much less me. And fortunately, God's kind of let us grow through all that. Sarah is now the most genuine, honest, sincere people I know, and our relationship has deepened tremendously through it because I value that. I don't value when people will say, you're lying to me, or often I hear this, I'll say, you know, I'll answer a question and they'll say, I don't think you really believe that. And then they'll have a conclusion. You're actually this way. And they'll have an accusation. Hmm. And the accusation is kind of like, really? Honestly, that's not what I'm thinking. Yes, it is. And once you know my heart better than I know my heart, once you presume to take that place in any real, I never do it to anybody else. I never presume that I know what's in your heart better than you know what's in your heart. And that's even dealing with people that I know are embedded in illusions, that they do believe things that aren't true because they don't have an honesty component with their own life. They're so driven by fear or anxiety or whatever that they're just trying to put together conclusions that make them feel comfortable. But man, sincerity to me, even if you're struggling to get there, is a great value. Yeah. I like that when I read that. I like that I do pursue relationships. I will be in a town with somebody that I haven't seen in 25, 30 years, know they live there, and I'll make an effort to say, hey, let's get together and talk. I just want to see how your life's gone. And I think part of that's not so much, I don't know that I really value that friendship because it really isn't a friendship. I value the memory of it maybe. Mm-hmm. But what I really think of about people is there's a treasure of God in every human being we know. And if that's not buried under lies and delusions and whatever, I love just getting with people and what are you seeing? What are you learning? What do you know? What's your journey been like? I think there's always beautiful stuff to unpack in people, even if their journey's been rough and rugged and painful and they're a bit lost in it, and maybe angry at God. The journey, how they went from being a wonderful God follower to someone who's a little bit cynical and deluded about God things, I even find those conversations interesting. How did you get from there to here?
Yeah.
And how convinced are you that the here you've got to is really the genuine here? Or is there something different or better you might think about who God is to help you navigate that? And so when I read that more and more, I'm going, you know what? A lot of this stuff, God has worked in my heart, but I'll be honest with you. I don't think they were necessarily part of my personality, particularly for the first 42 years of my life. Things that have emerged later, and I'd credit that not so much to Wayne's personality, but as to the work of God in a heart that living loved learns to love differently in the world than I was capable of before.
It still cracks me up as you're talking, because when you said that when you started off with saying, I laughed when I first read this, I was like, okay, was that a good thing? Was that a bad thing? You know, like, and yet to hear that you were more of a task guy, that you liked airplanes more than you liked people, even though, yes, that was obviously a skewed test. There was some bias that was in there.
Sure.
But still, that just cracks me up to see. And I would agree with you. I think that's part of that journey of living loved and God untangling some of those other things and moving us into a more wholehearted space. And yet for you to read through that and be like, man, that wouldn't have been true for me for the first 42 years of my life. And, you know, I think about that and I was like, well, I don't know if we would have been friends for the first 42 years of your life.
Yeah, we probably wouldn't.
And vice versa. I don't think you would have liked me in my earlier days either.
And I don't know if the friendship would have grown because I've been very task oriented. And doing a book for maybe 20,000 people that read it is obviously more important than going to have coffee with this young kid who's disillusioned by his church experience and having that conversation. So even my values were skewed in the sense that I saw groups as more significant than individuals in terms of my efficient use of my time.
Yeah.
Two quotes I'll leave you with because we're over time, and I'm just going to leave these two quotes with you. They're ones that kind of play into this. One is from Marcus Tullius Cicero, an old Greek dude. He said, I've always been of the opinion that unpopularity earned by doing what is right is not unpopularity at all, but glory. That's not a believer, but man, I'm telling you what. When I read that, I'm going, you know, those are the people I've always admired. And I talked to one today, people who have earned unpopularity because they've done what's right instead of played to the crowd. And to me, that's the glory. That's probably the glory of God. That's Jesus, right? I mean, Jesus is bearing God's glory in the world, but it made him unpopular. People wanted somebody to go along with the status quo and help us out here, get what we want. And so they killed him. And the second one is by Dag Hammarskjöld, I guess. I don't know. I don't know how to pronounce his name. He says this, never for the sake of peace and quiet, deny your own experience or convictions. The only kind of dignity which is genuine is that which is not diminished by the indifference of others.
Ooh.
I love that. Man, if you have to go along to get along, you don't end up in real relationships. And life's too short to waste your time in faked up relationships that diminish who you are as a person because they want you to go along for peace and quiet. And that's some of my own journey right now. And I read that the other morning. I thought, you know, I love that thought. Never, for the sake of peace and quiet, deny your own experience or your convictions. That's all you have. And if other people are trying to distort your experience or your convictions, then better to step away than to keep recreating yourself to fit in with a group of people who don't love who you are. They only want you to serve their agenda. And that's never going to fly in my world, unfortunately, or fortunately.
I would say fortunately.
Thank you for traveling with us today on The God Journey. You can join this conversation by visiting thegodjourney.com.